Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne here at 88.5 KRFY, community radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month. You can also catch the show at 8 a.m. on the third Monday of each month, and our show and every show at KRFY is both on your radio at 88.5 or can be streamed at krfy.org from anywhere in the world. Additionally, you can listen to a podcast of the show at krfy.org and select podcasts. Currently, the monthly topics I've chosen to present feature the medical designations for each month. Since this is January, I'm focusing on the movement called Dry January. We'll discuss the latest findings regarding alcohol and your health and the programs available here in Sandpoint if you need an addiction counselor and psychological support. My guests are Sasha Maloney, licensed professional counselor in the Behavioral Health Division at Kinnickzu Community Health, and Kevin Knepper, CEO at Kinnickzu Community Health. I'm so happy to have you on our show today. Please tell us a bit about yourselves and your role at Kinnickzu.
Sasha?
So I have been a drug and alcohol therapist for 14 years, and I've also been sober for 15 years. So I specialize in people that struggle with substance use.
Very good. Very necessary.
I've been at Kinnickzu for 13 years. In fact, my 13th anniversary was just a few days ago. And I don't specialize in anything anymore as a CEO. I'm a generalist, and I try to provide great support for our teams for the great work they do in the community.
Did you come in through hospital administration, or what was your background?
Finance. I was the CFO for a number of years until our CEO and founder, Victoria King, passed. And then I stepped up and took her role about 7 years ago.
Okay. Well, I've seen the whole organization really expand. When I first came to town, I worked with Sandpoint Pediatrics covering for vacations. And so over the years, as Joyce Gilbert left, you've been quite increasing your services and, of course, the beautiful building you have. Susie Perez from our KRFY morning show and my executive producer is here with me as she enables KRFY to offer these discussions. Hi, Susie, and thank you for being here.
Well, good morning, Dr. Joanne, and thank you. Medical Musing provides the KRFY listeners with interesting and informative interviews on a variety of medical and health-related subjects, and I want to thank you for hosting this every month. It plays on Monday. Monday's the first Monday of the month and the third Monday of the month. But I wanted our listeners to know a little bit about you, Dr. Joanne. You're a longtime KRFY volunteer, previously hosting segments of Otto's Eclectic Mix, and is now you are hosting this Medical Musing program. You are a retired pediatrician who has lived in Sandpoint since 2010. You previously worked in a pediatric practice in Columbus, Ohio for over 30 years, and then moving to Sandpoint covered for Sandpoint Pediatrics. As the media spokesperson for the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, you contributed to print, online media, radio, and television. Dr. Joanne is a mother of four adult children, and I feel that we're very fortunate to have your show, Medical Musing, as part of our Monday morning programming. So thank you very much.
That was a very kind introduction, Susie. I chose the topic of Dry January for several reasons. Over the last several years, there have been so many articles refuting the health advantages of drinking alcohol. At the same time, there's been increased awareness of the movement called Dry January. Just in the last week, I've seen several articles per day regarding the good and the bad about alcohol consumption. On Monday, there was a review from the National Academy of Sciences touting the advantage of low to moderate drinking in those without a strong family history of alcoholism or certain cancers and cardiovascular disease. And then very timely, just on Friday, you may have seen that the Surgeon General issued a recommendation that alcoholic drinks should have additional labeling that states the consumption of alcohol increases the risk of breast, liver, esophageal, oral cancers, and several others. And then even National Geographic's cover articles this month discuss both the risks of drinking alcohol and how going sober can even for even a little while can improve one's health. So what do you think, how do you interpret these conflicting recommendations? Either one of you want to start?
Well, I think that people don't fully understand the effects of alcohol. And so it really depends on what side of the coin that you're on. So mm-hmm. there's people that don't come from a history of addiction. So they're going to have one point of view. And then you're going to have those of us that come from the other side that will have a different point of view.
Yeah, definitely. When you see the definitions of low, moderate, high, and binge drinking, it's like we were talking before the show started about 7 or 8 a week for women. It's like, but I've, you know, you can't like drink nothing Monday through Thursday and then, you know, almost binge on the weekend. You don't really save up your alcohol units to drink like that, because people who drink more than 4 or 5 drinks at a time will have much more problems with the next day or what they do or their inhibitions or things like that. Kevin, any comments?
I have to speak to it personally, and I think my relationship for alcohol, which is long, has gone through various stages, mm-hmm. and I think it's important if you're going to use any substance, and alcohol is predominantly acceptable, you've got to be honest about the impact it has on your life. Mm-hmm. And during COVID in particular, I found with less to do and more time on my hands that I was drinking more. And recently, for the first time, I've actually put restrictions personally on myself to create better discipline around how I my relationship with alcohol, and it's better for me, and I feel healthier because of it.
And I think that's the whole purpose of the program, because not everyone's going to stay completely dry, but it's to analyze what are you really doing and how can you change. Susie, any comments?
Well, we're talking about dry January. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a good starting point. We make New Year's resolutions. And if alcohol or any addiction is a part of something that holds you back or gets your attention, it must want attention. So it's a good time. Yeah, yeah. Perfect. Yeah.
When I researched Dry January, I thought it was really interesting that in 2012, just a gal in the UK named Emily Robinson decided to stop drinking for a month in January because she was training to run a half marathon. She was amazed at the physical benefits, such as weight loss, improved energy, sleep, and skin tone, along with the mental health benefits. Somewhere in the UK, too, in 2008, there had been a previous report of another person who attributed dramatic weight loss and increased energy by abstaining from alcohol for a month. It's like when I was a pediatrician, especially dads would come in and they have lost all this weight, and I'd say, "What did you do?" And they say, "I stopped drinking pop," you know, or, you know, if it was beer or something like that. And you go, "I guess I don't drink enough pop or beer to have it make that much of a difference." But certain people, I mean, that's a huge amount of calories they're consuming and they're not really thinking about it. So Emily's program was so successful that actually Alcohol Change UK picked it up in 2013 and they trademarked it. And there's even an app now called Dry Try that you can go on that app and put down how many units of alcohol. And the problem is you need to define, again, what's a unit. So I can do that now, or you can do that too. We look at 1.5 ounces of alcohol, one beer, or 5 ounces of wine equaling a unit. Is that the way you define it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, if you really have a double, that's really not one unit, it's 2 units a day. So, anyway, it's pretty interesting. I put my statistics in and I was pleased, but I'll, you know, still am working a bit toward Dry January, kind of like Kevin, that you just want to, that you don't really need a drink a day, or you don't really need to have 2 that day or whatever. The app is interesting because it even calculates how much money you're saving, and then you can give it to, not only it has motivation, you know, things in it, but also has tells you how much money you're saving and that you can donate that to a charity.
There's a lot of truth in there.
So, again, this whole program is emphasizing how much healthier you can get. You can improve your blood pressure, decrease the risk of early death from more than 60 illnesses, including the 7 cancers, and decreases your anxiety and improves your mood. I'm sure it decreases your anxiety once you really come to grips with what you're counseling. You probably, a lot of people are more anxious to begin with. But again, we're decreasing our calories, we're decreasing our sugar, and we're having a better relationship. Hopefully, that will lead to a better relationship with alcohol. There also has been so much promotion of non-alcoholic drinks. I don't know what you get in your feeds, but I get Ritual advertised all the time. And I sent my husband to buy it one time, and he said it was like $40. So a lot of these non-alcoholic products, they're Pentire and Seed Lips and all different combinations of non-alcoholic drinks that are supposed to be mimicking gin, vodka, bourbon.
Well, I think it, something like that can be a transition because you get used to the flavor, you get used to the ritual of having a drink, but you're taking the alcohol out. So it seems like a temporary kind of transitional thing.
There's non-alcoholic beer. I mean, we have a big, big poster, a big billboard right outside where we live in Columbus when we go back that advertises an IPA that's non-alcoholic. So everyone, you know, many, many companies have gotten into this providing non-alcoholic substances. I think seltzer or club soda or tonic or ginger beer is just fine, too, if you put a lime in it or something. And, and you know, if I'm thirsty, those are great things. So how do you promote or do you promote these non-alcoholic derivatives to your clients? Or is it better just to say, you know, to talk about abstaining?
So our program that I run, we are a total abstinence program. So I personally do not do harm reduction with my clients, including switching one for another. One caution about the non-alcoholic is they actually still have alcohol. It's just a very, very, very low amount to where you can't get intoxicated. And I've had clients in the past try it, but it was more triggering than it was with keeping them sober.
Interesting.
I'm just thinking about your program. I just wanted to know, I don't think we've gone into it that much, but when you're talking about the a little bit of alcohol, there's the physical addiction, there's the social addiction, there's all different ways that people move towards, well, just we're talking about alcohol right now. So why don't, can we hear about the program and how you bring people in? How do people get to you? And then what does the program look like? How do you support someone that's maybe they don't even know that they want to try to quit, but they're there for various reasons? Why don't you just describe your program?
So right now we offer a level one outpatient. What that includes is clients can do from 1 hour to 9 hours of treatment a week with me. All of the clients that are involved in the program do one-on-one sessions. They do like random UAs so that I can make sure that they are staying sober. And then they engage in our relapse prevention group. And so normally how people get referred to me is they get referred by like a probation officer, a family member, or themselves. And how it works is they contact two different people that work with me, and then they do their own assessment, and then they get put on my schedule for me to do my assessment with them, and then they are able to start treatment from there.
So what does treatment look like? I'm sure it's individual, but...
It is. So they do one-on-one sessions with me weekly, and that's where we like dive deeper into like their trauma and what has caused them to go down the path that they have gone down. They do groups, and then they're in treatment with me for about 3 to 6 months. It just depends on the person and where they're at.
So again, or a physician, I'm sure, can also send them in. It's so interesting that the incidence of alcoholism is, as I was doing my research, it was like, oh my goodness, 400 million people across the world. So not the U.S., but 7% of the world's population has some alcohol use disorder. And I mean, there are just 2.6 million deaths in 1 year, but again, that's across the world. A quote here is like 100,000 deaths and 20,000 or 100,000 cases diagnosed each year and 20,000 deaths. And I think that's related to the cancer, which was part of the Surgeon General's announcement or a press release on
When Friday. You say alcohol or substance disorder, mm-hmm. how does that defined? I mean, well, how do you know if someone, you know, has that?
Well, there's alcohol use disorder. Can you, are there different diagnoses that you work on for, whether there it's for billing or for whatever?
Yeah, so we use the DSM-5, which is the mental health. And then if someone comes in and sees me and I am doing their assessment, there are 11 different criterias that I go through with them. And then depending on how many of those criterias meet where they're at is where the mild, moderate, and severe with their diagnosis comes into play. And so if someone has like one to two of the different characteristics, they're mild. If they're a three to four, then they're moderate. And then five and up, they're very severe. And then we go from there with their treatment.
So I'm sure you asked the questions that define whether the alcohol use disorder, like have you ever hurt anyone? Have you felt like you couldn't stop your drinking? Do you ask those kinds of questions or mm-hmm. have you failed to do your normal jobs or the normal expectations of your life? Needed a first drink in the morning?
Yes.
I'm going to cough a little. Or felt guilt or remorse regarding your alcohol consumption? Mm-hmm. Are those the kind of standard questions that you ask?
Yeah, and then we ask if their substance use or drinking has put them in like a harmful situation, if they are using more than what they intend to use, if they're experiencing any withdrawals, because with alcohol especially, there's some very dangerous withdrawal symptoms that can happen with alcohol, and so we have to be cautious to make sure that they're safe when they're wanting to come off of it.
So do most people go like once a week for one-on-one and then they go to group, or how do you work that part of the program out?
So all of the clients in the program do a hour one-on-one a week, and then they also do the group. So they start out with 2 hours a week of treatment, and then if they need more, then I increase it from there.
Do you find that people are pretty receptive, or can you tell right from the beginning that it's not going to work for someone?
Yes. Yes.
What are those characteristics?
Normally, if someone's in pre-contemplation stage of change and that's where they think they don't have a problem, it will take me months to get them there. If they're in contemplation or preparation or action stage, they're pretty willing to engage with me.
So the first stage is, my partner just sent me here, or something like that.
Yep.
And so they're not really, really invested in the program. It's very pretty interesting. Over the years of your sobriety and your training then, have best practices changed at all?
Yes.
And is there something about that that you'd like to share with us?
So when I went to treatment, it was a lot more strict in the approaches and the way that the therapist treated clients. Today, we are a lot more gentle and we are a lot more understanding than when I went to treatment 15 years ago.
Interesting. Interesting. Kevin, you'd mentioned before the show that you had worked in San Francisco and knew of the inpatient program at Betty Ford.
Is that right? Delancey Street.
Oh, Delancey Street.
Yeah, I was a loan exec through United Way. I worked for United Parcel Service at the time. But for several years, I worked with the Delancey Street clients and population as they were coming out of the program to teach them finance, budgeting, how to do simple
skills,
tax returns,
skills,
things like that. Yeah, life skills, checkbooks. They still had checkbooks back then. I had a good view to what went on there. And at the time, it was, and probably still is, a nationally recognized program in three locations with a super high success rate, which at that point was 80%. So, I mean, 20%. So 8 out of 10 people who came to Delancey for addiction, it was everything from substance abuse to gambling to other odd addictions. 8 out of 10 would wash out or after they graduated the program, return to their previous behaviors. Yeah. And 20% was pretty good.
Yeah. It's so hard. Is there an average number of times you have to go through counseling, addiction counseling, before you're successful?
An average person we have found goes to treatment about 4 to 7 times.
Okay. Interesting.
Is there a kind of a propensity from a young age for someone to get into substances that alter their reality, so to speak, that is evident, or is it just so random?
There's a lot of different factors that lead into addiction, but we know a lot of it has to do with our genes and our environment. So if you are raised in an environment that enables that behavior, or if you come from a family tree of people that have had issues, you are more likely to indulge in those behaviors.
And when you say kind of genetically, what does that look like? Is it a certain kind of substance that you have, you know, a propensity towards? Or
so a big one that has had a lot of research with the gene factor is alcohol. And so if you come from a family tree of people that had issues with alcohol, that it can be passed down to your children.
Or even in utero.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You're born with it in your system.
Yep.
That really puts a jeopardy on that person's movement forward into life and being productive or happy in life. Yeah.
Well, the positive family history, but I'm sure then, I mean, if you were bullied at school, if you didn't quite fit in, you have some learning problems, all those things are cumulative or additive, aren't they?
So one of the biggest answers I get, and I know it was the same for me as well when I was using substances, is we wanted to feel nothing. So we wanted to escape whatever life we were in, and we found it in substances. So for a lot of people, that is their answer of why they started.
What's your percentage? Are the majority alcohol, or is it certain different drugs, or what do you find here in the North Idaho area?
So North Idaho this far is alcohol, meth, and fentanyl.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember when we first came here, there were all those billboards with, you know, how your face changed and how you're, you know, on meth. Mm-hmm. And then at Sandpoint Peds, because Joyce Gilbert was so involved in the foster care system, the hospital tested the babies right there. Mm-hmm. And if they had meth in their system, then they were fostered out immediately. One time I came into work and the nurse said, "Do you do shelters?" And I went, "What?" And that's what they called it here, was doing the first exam and then putting the baby into a safe shelter. It's just an interesting way to say it.
And then another big one is actually marijuana. Most of my clients are using marijuana when they come to treatment.
Why is that considered? It's legal in many states. Well, so is alcohol, tobacco. Mm-hmm. Why is marijuana considered addictive?
So we use what's called the scheduled substances chart. And so marijuana is actually a scheduled one substance, which means it's one of the most highly addictive substances out there. And so, yes, there has been some medical purposes, but most people that use it are not using it for those purposes.
So what defines it as addictive, meaning they do it on a regular basis? Mm-hmm.
They can't function without it. They are basically using it as a crutch. Like if you take it away, are they able to manage without it? And that's what I look at with the alcohol as well, is if I take this away from you for a week, are you able to stay away from it for a week, or are you going to have issues?
Is the marijuana more of an emotional crutch, or actually does it have physical addictive properties too?
It actually has both, but I have seen personally that marijuana's withdrawal symptoms are more mental and psychological than physical.
So you don't have the delirium tremens. I remember when I was being, you know, trained as a physician or even working as a med tech, that the ER would be full, not full, but, you know, someone, the DTs and the paraldehyde that smelled awful that they were given for their withdrawal. It's a medicine that they're given to help withdrawal.
There's some people that have, like, physical withdrawals from, like, the marijuana, but I have seen more of the mental side of it than the physical side.
It becomes a lifestyle that defines their movement in forward.
Yes.
Right.
Well, again, that's the conflicting with marijuana. It's kind of like, well, if you're going to, you know, use it, then the state might as well get the taxes. However, how is it going to be monitored, and how are you going to do affecting your driving and doing this and, you know, all those other ramifications?
A lot of addiction, like with alcohol and tobacco, it has negative potential physical, like cancer, or with alcohol, you become in, you know, out of control. I don't even know the terms for some of that, but drunk, I guess, is the word. And so then it affects your life. You can't drive, or at least you shouldn't drive. But with marijuana, are there things like that also that, okay?
Yes. So marijuana affects our reaction time. So if you're driving and something happens, a deer or someone abruptly stops, your reaction time to process what is happening is a lot slower. It also affects your ability to understand your emotions or be able to handle them correctly. And then it also affects your motivation as well.
So it's interesting, as we are talking about the services here, it just reminds me of why people are confused, too. And I mean, the people that come the first time and they're either sent by someone and they're not really in the stage that they're going to benefit from therapy. Because many people still remember the 1990s and the continuing today, even, that some moderate drinking was and is contributed to better health or longevity. Cardiac disease and cancer were more attributed to the high-use people and not the low or moderate use. Morley Safer on 60 Minutes touted the French, who ate pâté and triple cream brie, but they drank red wine, which then had a flushing effect, or decreasing the blockage in your coronary arteries. And people that, at that time, even the Mediterranean diet was just coming out, and that also encouraged a glass or two of red wine. So basically, alcohol sales were increasing from the 1990s up till somewhere in the 2000s. And then, of course, the pandemic came, too. But that a lot of people showed, I mean, there was a study in 1997 that said that 490,000 adults, and they had one drink a day, and they were 30 to 40% less likely to die from cardiovascular disease and 20% less likely to die of any cause, which I read, well, that's, you know, you didn't follow them long enough, because everyone eventually is, you know, going to pass away. So I'm sure that if I drank a day, eventually the statistic would change. But, and then there were some people in the 2000s that said, well, the population was actually a little skewed. They were usually people who were wealthier, healthier, had more care, did more exercise anyway. And so the population wasn't quite right. And they redid the studies. And then, of course, they said that alcohol is a carcinogen, and alcohol is, because it's metabolized into acetaldehyde, which is a compound that can destroy parts of your body. So I'm going to cough a little.
I wonder why Kinnick-Sue chose to have support for addiction in your program. What prompted that? Has it always been there for the 13 years you've been involved, Kevin?
No. Mental health was a very small part of what we've done traditionally. But for a number of reasons, the population's grown sicker. Addiction percentages are up. The stigma around seeking help for mental health issues as a whole has been reduced. And there's financial incentives that help you invest in those areas where traditionally you couldn't get funding for behavioral health. And the reimbursement rates and the respect afforded to the licensure for therapists in behavioral health versus other medical fields is less than it should be. So it's been hard to expand. And even as we sit here, there's a shortage of particular substance abuse counselors in our counties, but certainly mental health clinicians as well. But we responded. My passion is for kids. Interesting, you're a pediatrician. I'm an adoptive father and had a troubled childhood myself. So we really wanted to focus on building out pediatric mental health services, and then we've increased our adult services as well. And we're just responding to the need. That's what we're trying to do in our community is meet need with solutions and services. And so with that increase demand for mental health services and recognition that it's okay to ask for help, we're responding to it and building our workforce and our services around that.
So besides the addiction corner of mental health, do you have other services?
Sure. Yeah, we just, we're 2 years into a, I guess I'd call it a demonstration project with SAMHSA, which it's called a CCBHC, which I believe is Certified Community Behavioral Health Center. Sometimes I get that wrong. And it adds a full spectrum of mental health services, everything from traditional counseling, substance abuse, to peer support case management. And our goal is to expand that program to make sure that we can meet people, whether in a maintenance need, substance abuse crisis, along that spectrum of mental health. And it's going quite well. We've got two more years in the project with SAMHSA, but I imagine post-demonstration we'll continue that.
And SAMHSA is a mental health based program, right?
It's a federal agency. It stands for Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Association.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I thought I knew, but I think defining it for our listeners is good.
So a lot of our evidence-based curriculums come from there, like from them, and then a lot of our trainings as well. So a lot of us therapists, either if you're in the substance use side or the mental health side, we go to them for like our go-to knowledge and stuff.
The newest information, because it's constantly changing,
yes,
is what I'm getting. New information, new studies, and as the population grows, not only on the planet, but here in our North Idaho world, more and more there's more need.
Absolutely. And
how many counselors do you employ?
Oh, it's growing. One substance abuse counselor at the moment. We need more.
Yeah, we are very grateful.
We're moving towards two.
Shout out to Tamarack, actually. Does a great job with substance abuse in the community as well. And I believe we've got 11 other clinicians right now.
Well, there's so much emphasis on anxiety and, you know, whether it be the pandemic or just in general, kids and screens and this and that. But so, again, as you said, there's more recognition and more people are willing to come and get services. And on the addiction side specifically, does their insurance pay? Do they self-pay? What is the payment structure for counseling programs?
So it actually depends. So if they have a substance use diagnosis, which I give them during a assessment, it becomes a medical need for that client, so their insurance will pay for treatment. Some clients are there for other reasons, so they're self-pay. It just really depends on their situation.
And you probably see the full spectrum of motivation, too, from, yeah, I'm going to take care of this, you know, your clients, take care of this, and or denial.
Yes.
Yes. Are any of your clients, patients, put there mandated by the court system? I think you may have mentioned that. So, especially if they got a DUI or something like that.
Okay. Yes. The DUIs have spiked. And so a lot of people are coming to treatment for the DUIs, either due to alcohol or marijuana. Mm.
Interesting. So it goes from the police to the probation officer to their physician and whatever. And
get some help. Mm-hmm. Does the Kinnexu Community Health and your program specifically, Sasha, does it provide, you know, kind of like outreach and education also?
Yes.
As part of the program?
Mm-hmm.
And that's all on you?
Mm-hmm. Well, me and like the other therapists and stuff like that. But as far as like the addiction aspect of resources, I do educate my clients on it.
Interesting. Well, just a little bit more about, like, the World Health Organization does state that no amount of alcohol is safe and does not improve your health. So, and they emphasize that it's a known carcinogen. Ireland actually has a cancer warning on all alcohol. So I have to go look at Guinness. Probably not in the U.S., but you can find a bottle of Guinness that was manufactured in Ireland. And Canada is considering the warning that even small amounts of alcohol can be damaging to your health. So we'll see where this Surgeon General report goes to if we end up with. It does say already about using machinery, right? Motor vehicles and machinery.
And a lot of times clients think they don't have a problem because it's not affecting them physically. And I think a lot of people focus on the physical aspect, but really alcohol affects you mentally just as much, if not more. So alcohol is a depressant, which means it feeds off of those negative emotions. So if you are already diagnosed with anxiety or something like that, it can actually intensify it.
Kind of the snowball effect.
Yes.
Right.
Very interesting. That alcohol can actually, even just one drink or a low dose, can decrease. There still is evidence that it decreases your risk of heart disease, but it also can increase your risk of heart disease. So it's not written on your forehead, as I say to people, what their background is, what their family history is, whether it be of substance abuse disorders or of heart disease or hypertension or cancers. The association with breast cancer I thought was interesting, too, because we've done a show on breast cancer. But alcoholism is actually a risk factor for breast cancer because it increases your estrogen levels. And reflux, I know a lot of people who have a lot of reflux, GI problems with alcohol. Liver cancer, we've all talked about, or probably more people have heard about cirrhosis or hepatitis due to drinking alcohol. The people who drink more severely, or the high amount, the heavier, the binge drinker especially.
When you think about the dangers of addiction, even though people might hear about the new study on alcohol, no amount is good for your physical health. People have known about cigarettes for years, and tobacco use hasn't stopped. So,
It took forever.
It took forever.
I think there's we're in an interesting part of our society and culture right now where the experts aren't trusted, primarily as a result of the pandemic and the fact that there was so many expert opinions that were in conflict and so many motivations for that. So I think the studies on alcohol for me are more like the studies on coffee. And so every few years, coffee cures everything, and then coffee's bad for you, and the same with alcohol. And I'm sure another year from now, there'll be another study comes out touting the benefits of alcohol. Uh-huh. So I don't think it's a settled question yet. And I think that ambiguity kind of creates the risk. Yeah. Increased risk for people who are susceptible to addiction or even moderate levels of alcohol, however you measure that, are harmful for them. So
yeah, it's obvious why people are confused, too. Yeah. And
yeah, where's the study done? Who's paid for it? I always ask that.
Well, no, and that was one of the things that I found really interesting, that after the World Health Organization said no amount of alcohol is healthy and it is a carcinogen, that then the lobbyists, the alcohol lobbyists and the drug lobbyists got on board and said, no, you have to redo this because, you know, we want to be able to say that. Not exactly what they said, but that's how I'm interpreting it. Yeah. That, you know, one drink a day or four drinks a week, you know, you'll be fine and actually you'll be healthier in some ways, perhaps.
The term moderation comes into play. So. And that's not true for everyone.
No.
For some, one drink is not moderate. It's the addiction point.
Well, and it depends on what model of addiction you're looking at. So a lot of us believe in the disease model of addiction. Some people believe in the moral, you know, model of addiction. And so I think it depends too, because for some of us, one is too many, you know, but then for someone that doesn't have that same kind of mentality, one is just fine, you know? So I think it really depends, and there's a lot of gray area that comes when we talk about addiction.
Well, that's because the one can then lead to more in some people, and in other people, it's like, oh, yeah, I'll have a drink, and, you know.
So when you do your assessment, the initial intake, are you able to identify that, the difference in the person in front of you? Are they rationalizing? Are they okay with one? You know, obviously they're there for a reason. They showed up, but...
Well, again, and how honest are they? Is the one really a double or a triple?
Good one, yeah.
I've been a therapist on the addiction side for 14 years, and I feel like I'm pretty good at being able to read people. And I actually got my master's in addictions, and so I specialized in it. And so I think for the most part, I get a good read on people. Sometimes they get one off on me, you know, because I'm not perfect. But for the most part, I can tell from the assessment, like, where they're at and if they're going to benefit or if they're going to be a little tougher.
How many people come who've had relationship problems? Like, again, we hear a lot about date rape and unsafe sex and decreasing your inhibitions. Do people admit that to you?
Or yes.
Is that why they're being sent? Some of them?
Some, yes. During the assessment, people actually open up a lot more to me than what people realize. And I think it's my vibe. I think it's because they know that I come from the life in some aspect. And so it makes them feel more comfortable.
So they're, it's like talking to a friend.
Mm-hmm.
That's so interesting. Because, I mean, you think about girls in college or whatever, their first job, you know, it's like, it's so easy to have, you know, maybe more than you normally would drink, and then have, whether it be rape or just you don't even remember that you've had sex with someone. That's really a scary principle for parents, especially, and for the person. So we talked a little bit about your success rate, but any other comments about that?
So one thing that I try to remind people is that clients get what they put into treatment. And so if they don't want it, they're not going to be successful. But if they want it, they will. And so Kevin kind of mentioned it, but the statistics of people staying sober long term is very low. So if you look at 20 people that come into into treatment, 4 of them are going to stay sober long term. 16 will go back out.
So that 20% is a pretty is a pretty common figure.
Yeah, it fluctuates, but especially after COVID and stuff, like people having the motivation to make changes decreased a lot.
Why do you think that is?
I think COVID affected everybody in different ways, and at one point we were scared to leave our house. People lost their jobs. And so the one thing that was always there for them, which was the alcohol or the drugs, was there. And that's the one constant they had. And so it increased because they couldn't do anything else.
If someone is on a substance of some sort and has the addiction quality to their use for a very long time, is it harder to get off than if it's a short time, or is that not part of the equation?
It depends on the person, but I have known people that were addicted for a year and had a harder time than someone that was addicted for 5 years.
Okay.
I think it just depends on their age, their background, and of course the substance, because some are harder to get off of than others.
What's the hardest?
Heroin.
Oh.
And alcohol.
It's just what is going on that you don't see is always kind of scary and interesting. I mean, it's, you read about fentanyl deaths and heroin and cocaine, and then I go, I've never seen anybody except in a movie, you know, sniffing. But anyway, I'm sure there are people that I know.
I think that's an interesting thing that happens in our town. You know, it's magical. And if you can be in Sandpoint, I mean, it's a dream state, right? The first time you drive across that long bridge. But right underneath that dreamy, there's the underbelly of the hard parts of our society with addiction and abuse and whatnot. And so I feel honored to be able to support people like Sasha and the people doing the work at the Lilybrook Defense of Women and Children's Rights, who do the hard work in our town that gets done while the rest of us are enjoying the mountain and not on our boats, you know, so...
How can the public or our community wrap our collective hug around this idea that in our midst are people that are struggling?
I think that education is key. And a lot of times people fear what they don't understand. And so a lot of people don't understand the addiction aspect and how hard it is, you know. When I got sober, it was very, very hard. And I became a therapist to help other people escape, you know, what I did. And that's why I do what I do, is because I want to show them that there's another way. And so I think that the more education and the more that we can show people that are addicted to alcohol or substances are just that. They are also people and they have lives and they're struggling. And we all need support. Mm-hmm. And so the more that we can be there and not judge, I think the better off we are.
Well, it's so interesting. In a ski town or a resort town or whatever, we always look at, gee, it's getting more expensive to live. So how can you support yourself being, you know, working on the mountain or working in the restaurants? How many jobs do you really have to have? Mm-hmm. And what stress is that putting on? And you have the addictive personality or the alcoholism history in your family. That obviously what triggers them over. How many people do you refer, or do you refer people for inpatient therapy?
So far, I have not, because they have not met criteria. So when I do a assessment, there's certain questions I ask. One thing we make sure that we do is that we are not overextending what we think they need. So it's not based on my opinion. It's based on evidence of what they're stating to me. So far I have not referred to inpatient, but if I ever did, it would be down in Boise because we don't have one up here.
Is that a problem that there's not services quickly available?
Yes. inpatient is a need. Outpatient is great, but for those that will not strive in outpatient and need more structure, they need inpatient, and it's very scarce with substance use, which is sad.
Yeah. So Coeur d'Alene is not thinking about having one, or as far as you know, they're not thinking about
it? As far as I know, they had one, but I don't think they're there anymore.
Okay.
Don't quote me on that, I think the closest one is in Boise or Seattle.
So, not even Spokane?
I don't believe so. But KDH down at, which is inpatient at Coeur d'Alene for, I think, 10 and 14 days, but that's more mental health. Severe mental health episodes, and substance abuse may be a component of it, but it's not specifically addressing that, to the best of my knowledge.
It's interesting because years ago, the inpatient that I knew about was Hazleton in Minnesota, and then Betty Ford in California. And now I've learned that they've merged, and they actually, Hazleton, Betty Ford is together, and they have centers in 9 states, and sometimes they even have more than one. So that was sort of interesting, but there is a one in Washington, but that might be the Seattle.
Yeah, we definitely need more inpatients. We need more substance use therapists. Like, we need a lot more when it comes to the substance use part of things.
How does AA, Alcoholic Anonymous, that was Joanne's next question.
That's the next thing. So
how does that fit into what you do? Do you refer to that? And is that kind of a longer-term support system?
Our program is not AA 12-step based, so we are evidence-based. So I specialize in cognitive behavioral therapy, and that's what I do. But AA or NA is a great long-term resource. There are meetings everywhere. I go to ones that are in Paris, you know, because I can do them on Zoom. And so AA gives people a foundation of support of knowing that they are not alone. From what I hear, the AA in Sandpoint is pretty good. The one down in Quarter Lane is good. Of course, we need more because it is a anonymous group. So they don't take funding from like the government or anything like that. But it is a good long-term support. Obviously, you need to have more program than just that, but that's a good starting point.
But yeah, it's actually, when I was looking at it, it was District 14 of the Alcoholics Anonymous in North Idaho. And there is a 24-hour helpline. So again, I don't know their statistics, but if we want to put that in on Facebook, it's 1-800-326-2164.
I will try to get that on.
And there are face-to-face meeting. I mean, there are all these. You talked about virtual. In Paris, do they talk French or Spanish?
Yeah, okay. So what's interesting, one aspect of COVID that opened up for the addiction community is the ability to do telehealth and do like the virtual meetings. So I can go to meetings in like Ireland or Paris or England, but I also go to the in-person, you know, ones as well. But it does open that up to where you can meet different people from different cultures. And
well, yeah, and that's the French that drink, the French and the Italians that drink a half a bottle of wine per person every night. So they've really flushed their arteries. There are face-to-face meetings, online meetings, as Sasha said. I mean, this District 14, I think, goes all the way from Newport, Washington to Libby, Montana. Open meetings, closed meetings, meetings kids can come with, can come to.
A lot of support out there.
So there are, so do you then say, recommend them to go, or because it, you're evidence-based and they're 12-step?
I do if they ask.
Okay.
I do not open up that door. Once they open up the door, I can answer their question, but I do not push it on any of the clients.
Okay. Interesting. And then again, even in restaurants, talking about the mocktails and what's available non-alcoholic, it's just blossomed. But I can understand why you don't recommend them drinking the non-alcoholic products, water, club soda by itself, tonic. With lime. Sometimes I'm not sure I can tell the difference anyway. In a restaurant, the ice has melted so much that it's probably... but anyway, there's so many products that people can drink. And basically, again, water. Is water your main recommendation? Or
yes. But I'm also a health nut, so yes.
Yeah. So you don't want to recommend Coca-Cola, not cocaine, but Coca-Cola that used to have cocaine in it.
It did. It did.
My goodness.
It did.
But, so I mean that, again, if we're talking about empty calories and how you can feel better without sugar and calories and this and that, water would be the...
I always go back to, it's our one life here. It's... why don't we get the most out of it we can in real life? I always think of any substance, including alcohol, as the only thing I do is coffee, only on broadcast days so I can talk.
Depending on, you know, what studies out that this week or this month or this year.
Moderation of coffee, my motto.
So as we're wrapping up, I mean, we can all make our New Year's resolution by participating in Dry January to either abstain or cut back on our alcohol consumption. Knowing the services that Kinixu Community Health is, I have a good resource for referring anyone I think needs to be there. But we can still toast each other with anything, with water, with tonic, and say cheers and enjoy our non-alcoholic libations. Thank you so much for joining me. I think it was a great program, and we learned a lot about the programs available here and a little background about drinking alcohol and other consuming other substances. Thank you all for listening to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne. Please do remember that this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. Please tune in next month on February 3rd when we'll be discussing cardiac rehabilitation, as February is Heart Month. This is 88.5 KRFY, community radio for North Idaho. We'll have a little musical interlude, and again, thank you all for listening.